I'm John Krall. May is Foster Care Month. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the challenges that come with taking care of some of the state's most vulnerable citizens, foster children. My guests are Katie Quay, a foster care consultant for the Indiana Department of Child Services. She's also a foster parent and adoptive mother. Gwen Collell, she is director of Damar Foster Care Services, and Rhea Langdon, a licensed foster parent. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about foster care in Indiana. May is National Foster Care Month. We're going to mark the occasion by having a conversation about the challenges and realities of providing foster care. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Katie Quay. She is a foster care consultant for the Indiana Department of Child Services. She's also a foster parent and adoptive mother. Gwen Collell, who is director of Damar Foster Care Services, and Rhea Langdon, a licensed foster parent. Welcome to all of you, and I guess in Gwen's case, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
She's been on the show before. So we probably, I always like to start shows like this by making sure everyone understands the terms, because I think people get confused between, you know, what a foster parent is, what a step parent is, what an adoptive parent is, and all of that. So largely, Gwen, because you're looking at me right now, I'm going to ask you to talk about what a foster parent is and what a foster parent does.
Well, in the state of Indiana, a foster parent is someone who becomes licensed through an agency or a licensing entity and works collaboratively with their agency in terms of following state regulations deemed to be appropriate for child welfare and for caring for children in the home. And then they work collaboratively with their agency, with the Department of Child Services, to make sure that the children are well cared for and that have all their needs met, services are in place, things along those lines.
So, Katie, give me an idea of how many people are involved here. How many foster children are there in the state of Indiana? And I realize the number fluctuates. People move in and out of the system, but roughly.
Okay, John. At this time, we have about 7,000 children in foster care, and we also have another approximately 5,000 children on relative and kinship placement, which are also foster homes.
Okay, so run those numbers by me again real quickly.
Approximately 7,100 in foster care.
Okay.
And approximately 5,000 in relative and kinship placement.
Okay. What is the difference between foster care and relative and kinship placement?
The difference, John, is that relative or kinship placement is a home that has people in it that the child knew prior to becoming involved with DCS. So it could often be a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a teacher, a neighbor.
Okay, so it is not someone. Now, do those folks have to go through the same sort of licensing procedures that a foster parent does?
A relative or kinship home does not have to be licensed, but we do encourage them to become licensed for the children we've placed with them only, so that they have the support, the financial benefits, and all the services that we provide to all of our families.
Rhea, you are a licensed foster parent. First, tell me about what that process involved, how you became a licensed foster parent.
Well, I looked at the different agencies within Indianapolis that I was wanting to choose to work with, to get trained, to be supported in my endeavors. My partner, of course, and I looked into this about 5.5, well, actually it was about 6 years ago we started. And you look at an agency that is going to not only give you what you need, but is ultimately what is going to give the kids what they need, mm-hmm. And can work well with you, understanding where you're coming from, understanding where the kids are coming from, all of that information. So we started, like I said, about 6 years ago. It's a process of getting trained, many hours of understanding trauma with children, all types of abuse and neglect, understanding your own background, where you come from, understanding how that will, you know, come, those issues might come up when you're actually caring for children and what to do with that as well. So there's there's a lot to really think about when you're getting trained. Mm-hmm. Then once you get trained and licensed, you're good to go.
Gwen, that sounds like a fairly rigorous process. How long all told does it take?
It varies, but if we're looking at kind of an average, about 3 to 4 months is about a fair time frame if everything moves accordingly.
So this is not something you do on a notion.
No. Rhea mentioned the training aspect, and then in addition to those training hours, there is a lot of paperwork to be filled out and a lot of, you know, background information that the agency delves into and gets from that family. You know, and spends time getting to know the family and assessing them, their strengths, areas of growth. So when we're looking in the future at placing a child in their care, that we have a really good understanding of that family and what child or sibling group may be a good match for that family and benefit from being in that family's care.
So, Rhea, I got to ask, I mean, it's a significant commitment before you even see a child, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Why? Why did you want to do this? Why were you willing to make that commitment?
Honestly, I had thought about wanting to foster, and then obviously later for myself and my partner, we wanted to adopt. Mm-hmm. But I've wanted to do this since I was about a teenager. Mm-hmm. I had a cousin who was adopted. And I knew at that time there were so many children, it didn't matter where you lived, what country, what state, city, so many kids that just don't have what they need from their biological family. And they get into the system and they need good homes, they need security, they need safety, they need medical help, they need all types of things. And it was just something within inside of me knowing who I am as a person, and obviously finding a partner that was very similar in those wants and needs, that I wanted to really help as many kids as I possibly could. And, you know, I waited till a certain point in my life that I was ready emotionally, you know, financially, stability, you know, all that, to then make the commitment, because it is a true commitment. It's not, like you said, there's nothing you do on a whim when you're mm-hmm. a foster parent. So, you know, it took me a few years, and then we were ready. We were ready, and we took on the challenge, and we've been running with it ever since.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about foster care in Indiana. May is National Foster Care Month. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Katie, there are about 12,000 kids who are in some form of foster care at this time. Does that number fluctuate a whole lot, or does it, does it remain relatively static?
Unfortunately, John, over the past several years, it has just continued to increase. Since last year, we have approximately 3,000 more children that have been deemed CHINS, which stands for Child in Need of Services, and those are the children that we're working with. Unfortunately, the trend has just continued to go up. based on different factors in the community.
So do we have any idea what those factors are, reasons that the number might seem to be climbing?
The great majority of children that come into care is for neglect, mm-hmm. and there is usually a root or a base problem in the family. What we see a lot is substance abuse, domestic violence, and parental mental illness. That accounts for the great majority of children that are placed in the system.
So is it fair to ask, I mean, we've done shows, and obviously there's been a lot of attention devoted to, the growing opioid crisis and all of that. Has that been a contributing factor to the climb in these numbers? Because 3,000, I mean, by my math, that's a 33% increase, roughly, or about 30% increase.
Unfortunately, yes, the drug abuse phenomena is affecting every aspect of our community, and probably 50% of the children we're working with, there is a substance abuse component in the biological home.
So let's look at the other part of this equation. We know that there are roughly 12,000 children right now, and that's up quite a bit from the past, who are in need of foster care. How many foster parents are there? Potentially, are there enough to go around, or is there a need there? I'll stay with Katie on that one, but I see Gwen is nodding her head, and I'll give her a chance to weigh in too.
Okay. At this point in Indiana, Department of Child Services has 3,800 licensed foster homes. There's about 2,000 more that are licensed through private agencies. There are homes, and we can find places for our children. However, we can't always find the best home in the community where the child is from. We would like to keep them in their school with their friends. We don't want to have to move our children out of their home community if we have to take them away from their parents.
Gwen, you were nodding your head.
Well, I was. I mean, I would think, or I would say with the increase of need over the last, year, and again, as Katie mentioned, it exponentially has increased year over year. So it does appear from my viewpoint that there are not enough foster homes available. We get many referrals, throughout each day. And I don't think this is specific to my agency, that it, is mm-hmm. across the board that there are, are not enough homes available for either, a single child or keeping siblings together, or as Katie mentioned, keeping them within their community. The nice component is we have several shelter care facilities throughout the state, which help offset a placement need if something is not available in terms of a foster home within that day or that week. But, the goal is not to have children remain in those shelter care facilities, to actually get them into a home environment with a family and have opportunities to remain in their school system or just have a little bit more of a normal family setting instead of remaining in shelter care for significant periods of time.
So and we probably ought to talk about this. I mean, it sounds like in Rhea's case, this was more a moral or spiritual imperative that drove her forward. But are there tangible reasons that one might become a foster parent? What do foster parents get out of helping to provide this service and care? Gwen, I'll throw that to you.
Well, we do have reimbursement to families to help offset the cost. The children that do come into care do have Medicaid health coverage. There are some other programs available that foster parents can utilize. WIC, the child care daycare voucher, and things along that line to at least help assist them with the work they're doing and the care they're providing for the children.
Can we quantify that? Can you give me an idea? I mean, I'm gathering that no one gets rich doing this. Rhea's shaking her head. Shaking your head doesn't work so well on radio.
Sorry.
People can't see it, but
But, you know, to offset the expenses, because I know as a parent of two children myself, they're not inexpensive to raise. Gwen.
I don't know if we can necessarily quantify it. It is an offset.
Okay.
You know, so you have to be able to be a family in a home that is, you know, you don't have to be rich.
Okay.
But you have to be, you know, financially stable too.
Well, I guess what I was trying to get at is what the reimbursement might be or something like that. But we can pick that up after the break. We're talking about foster care in Indiana because May is National Foster Care Month here on No Limits. My guests are Katie Quay, a foster care consultant for the Indiana Department of Child Services. She's also a foster parent and adoptive mother. Gwen Kalel, she is director of Damar Foster Care Services. And Rhea Langdon, a licensed foster parent. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about foster care in Indiana because May is National Foster Care Month. My guests are Katie Quay, a foster care consultant for the Indiana Department of Child Services. She's also a foster parent and adoptive mother. Gwen Kalel, she's director of Damar Foster Care Services. And Rhea Langdon, a licensed foster parent. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Katie, before we went to the break, I asked a rather imprecise question, and I'll try to make it a little more precise. When I asked about what the foster care parents receive in return, in addition to the moral and spiritual satisfactions of doing the work, whether there is something that helps offset the tangible expenses, some sort of per diem. Could you talk a little bit about what that is if there are people out there listening to this program and thinking, boy, I'd like to do it, but I'm not sure I've got the wherewithal to take in another child?
Sure, John. The word you use, per diem, excuse me, that's the word we use. It's Latin for per day. Foster parents get paid a per diem per child to care for the children. The per diem is based on the needs of the child. So a very young child with few needs would have a low per diem. An older child with more needs and more requirements would be more. The very lowest per diem is approximately $20 a day, and it goes up from there. There are also allowances that we provide our foster parents so that they have money to buy Christmas presents, birthday presents, and extra items the child would want. Summer camps, cheerleading outfits, prom pictures, those are all allowances that we will reimburse our foster parents for.
So what does it, if we know that it bottoms out at $20 a day, what's the very top end?
I don't know.
I think it's, I want to say around 68. Somewhere between 65 to 68.
Okay, so it's a narrow... Now, Rhea, I'm going to ask, and I know, Katie, you've also been a foster parent. I have a line of questioning that deals with looking at that this whole challenge from two perspectives, because you do that. But Rhea, is that money sufficient to offset the costs of being a foster parent, or you just have to go into this thinking, no, you know, if I want to do this, I'm going to have to dig in and provide some of the support myself?
Well, I really think it depends on the needs of the child. Honestly, we've had several different ages, different needs throughout the years. And depending on, you know, if they need, different therapies and if they decide to do sports at school or music or anything like that, it depends on what that child would want to do, need to do, things of that nature. For the most part, it does cover a lot of, their basic allowances for you know, buying clothes and the food on the table and things of that nature. It does help. But you don't get into it for that. I mean, you really, I mean, it's not going to, you know, cover everything, but it covers quite a bit. It does help.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Allie via email. If you want to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Allie writes, I grew up in a home that took in foster children for emergency placements. I chose to become a clinical social worker after these experiences. I so often run into negativity from individuals, including my own relatives, who believe that DCS caseworkers want to take children away from their families and somehow enjoy punishing parents. She puts punishing in quotes. As someone who's been present for removals, I can attest that this is one of the most heart-wrenching experiences and is not done lightly. How can we change the negative view that the public has toward individuals holding what I consider to be one of the most difficult jobs around? Katie, you're nodding your head. I think that spoke to you.
Yes. Thanks for the question, Allie. That's really good. The last thing we want to do is remove children. When we work with a family that has some challenges, we are going to step in and help that family. We're going to support them. We're going to provide services in the home so the child can stay there safely. If we cannot ensure immediate safety, though, in those situations, we have to remove the child until the family can address what the problem is. I would just say that removals are hard on the family, on the worker, as you said. They're absolutely heartbreaking. And our biggest goal at Department of Child Services is child safety. But second to that, the only thing second to that is reunification. 2/3 to 3/4 of the children that we remove will be successfully reunified with their parents.
Gotten another email from a listener named, actually this listener has chosen to remain anonymous, and writes, as a former therapeutic foster care case manager and current writer of home studies for prospective adoptive families, I think that it is imperative that we look at if the reimbursement, also called a per diem, was used differently, we might be able to weed out some of the homes that are unfortunately driven by that reimbursement figure. For example, if that money was put back into biological families through drug treatment, education, and provider income, we might be able to have less kids in foster care to begin with. Thanks for listening. Gwen, is that your response to that? Is that a workable idea?
From my perspective, I mean, I collaborate as an agency partner with the Department of Child Services, but I'm, you know, not on the at the table to make those, you know, big decisions about where, you know, how monies are dispersed. I mean, that's it's a great idea that, you know, she's presenting. And I think probably the biggest challenge is that the need is real. And so how does the state determine, okay, I think we have to be, you know, a lot, very future thinking in that possibility of putting those monies back into services for the families. Although, I mean, those services are increasing and getting, you know, much greater, not only for the children in foster care, but for the biological families. There, you know, there are programs, you know, parenting programs, drug treatment programs, and various other services that are provided to the biological family. So, you know, the funding is there and is being utilized in some way to assist those families.
Katie, is part of the testing to become a foster parent, I mean, is that designed to unearth or elicit motivation? I mean, if someone is doing this simply for the money, do those folks get weeded out, or is there a desire to weed them out?
Yes. Motivation is one of the biggest things we determine in the home study process. What is driving this family to do this? If a family thinks they're going to make money off foster care, breaking even is really the goal, but a profit is pretty unlikely. And just to add to what Gwen said about putting the money back into services versus foster homes, for biological parents that become involved with Department of Child Services, we spend thousands and probably tens of thousands of dollars per case providing free services to the biological parents. We will provide drug treatment, both inpatient and outpatient. We provide counseling, casework services, domestic violence counseling. You name it, we'll pay for it. Our job is to rehabilitate the entire family.
We're talking about foster care here on No Limits because May is National Foster Care Month. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do what several listeners have done and send us emails at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Bonnie has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly.
I appreciate it.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm really interested in trying to help start in the process of becoming a licensed foster parent with my husband. We've heard about friends who've like volunteered in other states, like with some of these children's homes where children stay in the interim before they're placed. I'm wondering if Indiana has an infrastructure like that where people can kind of get started and start working with some of these kids to help and see how it goes to then move on to becoming licensed foster parents.
Good question, Bonnie. Thanks very much for the call and the question. So, Katie, I'm going to throw that one to you first, and I'll paraphrase Bonnie's question. Is there a way to sort of dip your toe in the water before you decide to swim across the lake?
Yes. Okay. We find on average that people who become foster parents think about it for 2 years before they actually engage in the process. So it is kind of a thoughtful process for people. As far as volunteering, because we have to maintain confidentiality of our children, our family, I'm not sure that we would have people volunteering at emergency shelters and such because of the background check requirements. Department of Child Services does have a 1-800 number, which is 888-631-9510.
Go ahead and give that to them again.
Okay. It's 888-631-9510. We also have a website, fostercare.in for Indiana.gov. And both of those resources would, well, the call-in, you would allow, you would talk to someone at the foster care helpline. They would talk about the process, the requirements, and how to get started. On the website, you can see frequently asked questions, what the rules are as far as requirements to get started. So we do encourage people to look at our site and to give us a call.
So we ought to talk now about what the challenges are when children move into foster care. What are the things that they need the most? Because that might help if there are people out there trying to make up their minds about whether they want to do this, to understand. Gwen, I'm going to start with you on this. I mean, I realize every child is different, so asking a general question like that is dangerous and somewhat oversimplifying. But are there, you know, common things that apply across the board when you're dealing with a child who, for whatever reason, has had to be removed from his or her birth home?
As you mentioned, every child is different. So, you know, that what that looks like for each child, of course, varies. You know, the underlying theme, and Rhea had mentioned earlier that, you know, in the training process, we look at trauma. And I think our system is very trauma-informed. And again, that's a pretty broad term and a pretty mm-hmm. general term. But it's, you know, underlying in the needs and the emotional challenges that a child may have, even some of the behavioral challenges in coming into care. You know, they are scared.
Mm-hmm.
They are now with, you know, strangers, and with the way, you know, we have to look at sometimes placing children outside of their community. You know, now they may be in a different in a different community, a different school, possibly a different cultural, setting. So, I don't know if I'm answering it probably as specifically as I would like to, but it is, just important to understand kind of what that trauma based on their experience, and that experience is going to be different for every child.
So, Rhea, maybe I can ask this in a different way. What do you do? First place, how many foster children have you served in the time you've been a foster parent?
Including respite,
yeah,
which is like basically a break that a foster parent can get, around 20.
Around 20.
In 5.5 years or so.
Okay, so what do you do? Because, what we've established here is, by and large, these children are not in this situation by their choice. They probably would wish it any other way. What do you do as a foster parent to try to make that child feel that he or she is, welcome, should feel safe, should feel comfortable in your home and in your care? How do you approach that?
Well, you try to get as much information as you can about the situation. Sometimes it's an emergency pull type of a thing, and you don't have a lot of information about the child. DCS may not know a lot. My agency may not know a lot. So sometimes you just have to wing it when it comes to that part of it. But there's just a general, you have to help them feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, safe, you take it one day at a time, sometimes 1 hour at a time, to get them through the night, get them through the day. You talk with them as much as you can, as much as they'll talk back with you. If they're small or infants, things like that, you just meet their needs throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
But even infants, it's amazing what trauma can do to mm-hmm. infants. They have their own way of expressing that. But it really is just it's a comfort that you're trying to help these children in whatever means that they might need, whether it's a bath, a full tummy, maybe just to sit and feel comfortable with a blanket around them. It really depends on the child.
Gwen, you look like you want to say something.
I do, and it's a kind of going back to actually Bonnie's call, and Rhea had mentioned children that she had cared for, they had cared for through respite care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to point out because although the process of, you still have to go through the licensing process to become a quote-unquote foster parent, but people who provide respite, maybe this would be an opportunity to kind of dip your toes in the water, and it's just a short-term, it could be a weekend, it could be an overnight, maybe a week, in which the child's foster parent needs a break or has another obligation and the child cannot attend that with them. So we would place a child with a respite family.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a way maybe for Bonnie to consider, again, you have to go through the entire process and the vetting process, but it gives more an opportunity to understand the different types of children and the different types of needs and backgrounds and experiences that they've had.
And I should have asked this question earlier. Is there a cost to going through the vetting process and the training process?
There is not. I mean, in terms of maybe getting your home to meet the licensing standards, you may have to buy some extra smoke detectors or a fire extinguisher or things like that. But there is no cost to go through the training and licensing process.
Okay. We are talking about foster care in Indiana because May is National Foster Care Month. My guests are Katie Quay. She's a foster care consultant for the Indiana Department of Child Services, also a foster parent and adoptive mother. Gwen Collell, she's director of DAMAR Foster Care Services, and Rhea Langdon, a licensed foster parent. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about foster care in Indiana because May is National Foster Care Month. My guests are Katie Quay, a foster care consultant for the Indiana Department of Child Services. She's also a foster parent and adoptive mother. Gwen Kalel, she is director of DAMAR Foster Care Services, and Rhea Langdon, she is a licensed foster parent. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Susan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a couple of things I wanted to mention. In reference to the cost of becoming a foster parent, I didn't incur any cost for the education piece, but you do pay for the fingerprinting and so forth. And I did want to mention that people should probably be aware that anybody in your household would have to go through that as well. Like if you have guests coming over that are going to spend the night from, you know, family, friends, whatever, they have to be vetted as well, or at least have a background check done and the fingerprinting if they're going to spend the night. And I also wanted to mention that I'm a fairly new foster parent, about 7 months now, and it's amazing, scary, all the things that you think it was going to be, but very rewarding. But my biggest issue is the inability to plan anything for any period of time. Like school's ready to be over. You know, you don't know enough about what's happening with the case usually to say, okay, do I put them in camp? Do I plan on this? Do I do this? So that would be an area I think that could be a little bit better. Communication would be great.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your experiences, Susan. Rhea, I saw you nodding your head almost like a sewing needle over there while she was talking.
Yeah. Okay. It is difficult to plan. It kind of goes with the territory, unfortunately.
Well, Katie, I'm presuming that the argument there's some information that can't be provided to the foster parents to protect the privacy of the child and to some degree protect the privacy of presumably the guardians, the parents. Is that correct?
Correct. But, Susan, foster parents are supposed to be invited to court. You can attend the hearing for the child in your home, and that is a place where you can get some specific information. And I'm not aware of all the expenses involved with certain licensing agencies, but fingerprints for foster parents or household members or caregivers are always paid for through Department of Child Services.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Jen. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jen writes, what kind of support do agencies offer foster parents? Also talks a bit about respite care for the foster parents who need breaks. Gwen, I think that one's directed somewhat to you.
So the first part of the Jen's question, in working with a licensing and placement agency, support should be multifaceted and really directed towards the foster family. Obviously we're ultimately wanting to support the child, but the way we view that is by really giving that support and guidance to the people that are caring for the child. So we talked about, getting to know the family up front and understanding kind of their day-to-day lifestyle, what their household looks like, their schedules. And I think from an agency perspective, that allows when a case manager is working with the family and coming into the home, visiting with the child, visiting with the family, and giving guidance You know, knowing kind of their schedules and their day-to-day is very helpful. Other, you know, supports I mentioned, you know, case management, licensing support in making sure that the home meets all the safety standards. And that's very important, you know, to the agency and meets all the regulations and rules of the Department of Child Services. So the support is there to make sure that they receive the training that they need annually to maintain their license, and that, you know, again, their home meets the safety standards on a day-to-day to allow them to be a viable foster home.
Gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Gary, and again, our Facebook, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Gary writes, question, if a foster child applies to go to college and it may be better for them to find housing, do you know of any products available to assist those aging out? I'll throw that one to Katie, I think.
Okay, thank you, John. That there's a couple different avenues there, but we have a program with Department of Child Services called Collaborative Care, which is open to our youths who are aging out, 18 and up to, I believe, 20. We also can provide what we call host homes for children over 18, so they are no longer minors, but we will still financially support a family to allow that child to live with them. Collaborative Care helps with getting our youth driver's licenses, jobs, applying for college, and just developing the skills they need to transition into adulthood. I think all of us will acknowledge that when our own kids, biological or otherwise, turn 18, they're not ready to go. And we find that children in our system are no more ready to go than our own.
We are talking about foster care because May is National Foster Care Month. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Aaliyah has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Aaliyah, welcome to the program.
Hi, I have a question for you about foster care. Let me restate this. So there is an individual who has custody of his daughter. She has a sister that is her half-sister, but it's not his daughter. And she recently went into foster care. They would like to get her from the foster care, which is across state lines, and take care of her until the mother is better. But they don't know if they have to become foster parents to do that themselves and how that would work.
Good question. Thanks very much for the call and the question. Gwen, you happen to be looking at me, so I'll throw it to you first.
Well, if you're looking at a child that would be coming from, if I'm understanding her comment and question correctly, this child would be coming from another state into our state. So no matter when a child crosses state lines, there is an interstate compact process, which is overseen by the Department of Child Services. So someone within the county local DCS office where that the county of that home, they could contact that office and ask to speak with an interstate compact representative, and they can assist in that process of helping to see if it would be viable for the child to cross state lines and if that would actually be approved.
Yeah, Katie, I think Gwen just gave you your cue there because it is something. How much of this is interstate diplomacy of a sort and working with other State Department of Child Services?
Well, definitely has to be collaboration between the two states. But if this family has a kinship or relative relationship to this child, they could certainly request that they be evaluated for possible placement. But the other part of that is the goal of moving a child out of their home is reunification. So if this child is in another state and this child's parent is in the other state, we don't want to geographically separate them if we're still trying very hard to reunify them. So we would not move a child far away from their biological parents unless we were relatively certain at a point in the case that the child would need to be permanently placed with another family.
That raises another question, something I should have followed up on earlier. You mentioned that we don't always have enough foster parents in the right places right now, that there are, you know, to keep children in the communities in which they are living, allow them to go to the same schools, maintain their friends, all of that. Are there parts of the state that where it's harder to find foster parents than others? Are there certain areas where the shortage is more acute?
In my experience, Marion County seems to be particularly hard hit with some of the recent stressors on the community. And so many of the children from Marion County will go into the donut counties. We call them donuts, Hamilton, Johnson, trying to keep them relatively close, but not directly in their home.
Okay, so it one would think it might be rural areas that would be tough, but that's not the case. It's the because Marion County is perhaps the most urban county in the state.
But there are definitely some rural areas that I'm aware of that have high rates of drug problems, and they often do not have the resources for homes and services either.
We are talking about foster care here on No Limits. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
So I've worked as a home-based therapist in the system for about 6 years now, and I've seen a lot of kids obviously either have been placed already with foster placements and will go through several of them. So I'll see a lot of the unsuccessful ones and on the more rare occasions, the successful ones. But my concern is that we come across a lot of foster parents that have been through the licensing process, and there are several different agencies, so it tends to vary in terms of which therapeutic foster care agency has licensed them. But I run into a lot of issues where I know that they've been through the background process, and they've determined, as they've commented before, they don't want them to be kind of in this for the money. But I've run across several circumstances, and one in particular came to mind where I had a 16-year-old who was placed in a placement where the foster parent had agreed to take her under as because the case manager indicated she was what they call a level three, which is the, kind of the higher rate of payment per diem. And when she got placed with her, realized she was a level two. And again, this is kind of in multiple situations I've run into similar things, but this one was just kind of the more blatant one where the foster parent, once the child had already been there, indicated it's not worth my time to take a level two child. Nobody in their right mind would take a teenager and not do it for the money. I'm the only one that's honest about it is basically what she was saying. And this was an ongoing issue for a matter of a month. And the child ultimately had to be removed because of that. And that foster parent continues to get children placed with her. So I'm seeing that quite a bit. And you see, because we're so desperate for foster placements that we're willing to tolerate that once it happens. And that's my concern when we end up with those placements that are in the system. I wish that we had so much more of Rhea in this line of work.
Speaking of Rhea, she was about to leap out of her chair when you were saying that. So I'm going to give her a chance to react to that. Thank you very much for the call and sharing your story with us, Rhea.
It's very infuriating, honestly. These kids, there are so many that need safe, stable homes. And when you hear about individuals that do it for the money or will not, you know, as this case, she wasn't making enough money. It's beyond frustrating because it is not about the money. It is about what these kids need. These children will be taking care of us when we are older. If we don't take care of them now and help them grow and become, you know, successful members of our society, it's kind of scary.
Let me ask this of Katie. What is the process for someone being removed from the foster care as a foster parent? You know, if you hear a story like this where someone is not doing it for the right reasons, what's the enforcement process?
The enforcement process, if we have a family that has assessments and investigations called in on them, we screen them. the agency that's working with them can send us a complaint. There is a whole revocation process that we can go through, and unfortunately, we go through it too often. Ideally, if we enter into a foster relationship, which is it is a relationship with a family, in the beginning, and we discern that it is a financial motive, we should weed them out at the beginning. If we are aware that they are doing it for financial gain, we know that they will never be satisfied. A successful foster family has to be able to pay all of their own bills. I have to see their mortgage. I have to see proof of income to license them. It is an intrusive process, but we have to determine that they can meet their own needs and have a little extra left. And if we can't do that up front, we should not license them.
Got an email from a listener named Bob. Bob writes, "My wife and I were foster parents 12 years ago and adopted our sons through the foster system. They are biological brothers, and it has been a beautiful, rewarding, and loving experience. However, what I remember is the absolute nightmare of supervised visits and the lack of agencies providing this service. Also, the total lack of accountability for parents who continually not show up after we had arranged our schedule numerous times. Thank you." Is that one of the frustrations, Rhea, of dealing with this? Is that, and I would think another piece of this is success is returning them in theory to their biological families. That's got to be hard to say goodbye.
Oh, it's very tough. It's one of the toughest things you'll do, but when that is the goal, and it usually is from the very start, reunification, you know, you're there to provide the safety and support for not only the kids, but in essence, their family unit. And you have to have good communication with the other family. You know, if that's not happening, you need, you know, work with your agency so that there's communication there. It can be frustrating, but when it all, you know, comes down to it, a lot of times it's what the judge decides, you know, if there's any, what's the word I'm looking for, how many times they're able to keep skipping meetings and things of that nature. So
I want to try to, we've got like 30 seconds left. I want to squeeze one more question in. How does an organization like Safe Families coordinate with the foster care system? And do you have a feel for which level of care foster versus Safe Families has more need for host families? Katie, in about 15 seconds, can you answer that?
15 seconds. The Safe Families are working with children that are not involved in foster care. That's more of a preventative program. There is a need for Safe Families and foster families across the board.
So it's not an either or, it's a both and.
Correct.
Well, I would like to thank my guest, Katie Quay, Gwen Kalel, and Rhea Langdon for what's been an absolutely fascinating conversation about foster care in honor of National Foster Care Month. I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.